All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, my co-host and friend Sherry Coolidge, our buddy Silent Phil in the ones and twos. Today's special guest, author and entrepreneur from right here in Greater Cincinnati, Westchester, went on to big things in the biotech industry, and now is becoming a national voice in the conservative movement, Vivek Ramaswamy. If that name doesn't sound familiar, I think you're going to get your first listen of him, and I think you're going to hear a lot more from him.
Oh yeah, this is definitely you can say you heard him when.
Yeah, that's right. But first, Sherry, we like to talk a little whatever the latest political news is in this segment, and
not political news, as the case might be today.
She comes strong to the mic.
What have we heard for months out of City Hall? Ooh, corruption's so bad. Oh my God. Anti-corruption measures. Let's do this. What'd they do yesterday? Shot it down.
Correct.
Add a law committee. I don't think we're done hearing about this, by the way, but we just have one vote this week. Greg Landsman brought forward an ordinance that would have required council members and the mayor to disclose within 48 hours any campaign contributions above $200. The idea behind this is if you're taking a vote, then you'll know if there's a conflict. Did somebody involved in this project, Elman Liberty, give to people voting on it? And that seems like pretty much a gimme of like something that you would want to know as a citizen. But it turns out council feels like that's too hard.
So translation, it's too much work, essentially.
It's too much work to do anti-corruption measures, was my takeaway.
I mean, I saw this as we record here on Wednesday morning. I saw this news yesterday, and I'm like, well, you broke the story that he had this ordinance.
Hannah Sparling, actually.
Oh, sorry.
Pinch hitting at City Hall.
Good job, Hannah. Story on this, and I'm like, oh, that seems like an easy one. Pretty straightforward, not a big deal in terms of, you know, like, you know, I think we should start seeing more and more of these things. If you're not, you know, going to see like some big, massive, sweeping thing, which some people argue is too much. Some people say, yeah, that's what we need. But here was one I think we could all sort of agree on, like, and it essentially all it boils down to is that within a 2-day period, if you get a donation over $200, you just have to upload it to a database, correct?
Yes. And the point really here is that in Cincinnati, you know, developers and lawyers, for projects and architects, they give to the candidates. And that's free speech. You know, like there is a movement in some places, in this country to root out corruption, to say you can't make those donations. But this ordinance really kind of got around that point. Like, people can give who they want to
That's right.
who they want to. Like, this is America. You can't limit things like this. But just show us.
An accountability. And this is an accountability measure here that, again, didn't seem like such a big deal in terms of – it seemed like that's a slam dunk. Of course you're going to vote for that.
And Greg Landsman was the only person who voted for it, you know, and we saw David Mann running for mayor, abstain, I believe, from voting.
David Mann, who's, I think, going to try to run on the corruption or on the anti-corruption platform as the good government person all these years in office, and it's like, he abstains from this?
The anti-corruption task force was actually an idea drawn up by David Mann.
By David Mann. And like abstaining is the worst on something like this. Vote yes or no. Take a stand.
So it failed out of committee. So that's where we're at.
It fails out of committee. And Sherry, if I'm
the mayor, could
not one person voted for it.
The mayor could still put it on the agenda today.
As we all know, that's not going to happen. So let's, before we jump over to our guest, Sherry, in the long term here as we head toward the final months of this council and this mayor, Does this give you a thought that there aren't going to be really any anti-corruption measures put in place by this current council and mayor?
You know, that remains to be seen. This anti-corruption task force is supposed to come back, you know, with all of its recommendations in August. It'll be interesting to see if they put anything forward. That is pretty a quick turnaround by the end of the year to put forward some of these things. But it depends on how serious they are. You know what we did see? This was my favorite story out of Election Day, I have to tell you. Like, out of the clear blue, somebody called me and is like, hey, I just got asked to sign a petition for some anti-corruption measures. And I was like, what? Track that down, ask some people. Well, I heard this, I heard that, you know, that kind of reporting. What are we going to do while we're waiting for results? Well, I figured it out. Yeah. Tom Brinkman's actually bringing forward. These are eight ideas. They're going to come forward. His goal to get the signatures, put them forward in a charter amendment in the November election. But all together, you know, one of the most controversial things is going to be cutting council's salary, saying, you know, they make too much money. It becomes their only job. That makes it political. And so that is like, I think, the main topic. But there's a lot of things in, and, you know, I wrote a story about it on Cincinnati.com of where he's going with this. So here is a citizen who's like, hey, we need some anti-corruption measures at City Hall. And he's doing a petition drive. He's also obviously a state rep, but he's doing this as his citizen role as a person who lives in Cincinnati.
Yeah. And his idea is to put one big sweeping anti-corruption charter amendment on the ballot instead of sort of piecemealing it like we saw with issues one and two in the primary election. One big omnibus, robust piece of anti-corruption. And I'll tell you what, Sherry, it's getting late in the game to really make this thing happen and make these things happen. The first arrest was in February of 2020, Tamaya Denard. And here we are still today, mid-May, and there's not even really the process of anything being put in place yet. So anyway, let's jump over, bring on Vivek Ramaswamy. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and pleased to welcome to the podcast. He's really coming onto the scene back here in his hometown a lot lately. He is entrepreneur and author of the upcoming book, Woke Inc., Vivek Ramaswamy. Vivek, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So many things I want to ask you about. You are a man of many, many talents and interests. And but, you know, first of all, what do we want to talk about? you grew up here.
Well, more interests than talents. That much I will say at the game, but definitely have some wide interests. Yeah.
I think the thing we'll talk to you about first is, you have a book coming up, Woke Inc. And, can you talk about when that's coming out, what it's about? And, sure. You know, to let folks know, you are a constitutional conservative. You grew up here in Westchester and Evendale, went off to Harvard and Yale, and biotech entrepreneur.
Boy, not that long ago, 35 years old.
Not that long ago, right. star tennis player at St. X High. And then, you know, you've went into biotech, you started your own company, and you know, now you've sold the company, you're moving on into the political realm. You write, you contribute to National Review, Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and you've written a book. Tell us about the book, when it's coming out, and what it's about.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to do that. So it's coming out in August, and it's about the new merger between big business and big government, the way that politics has become an inherent part of doing business in America. And there was always something that bothered me about it. It's a trend that I had seen, even my own experience as an entrepreneur and before that as an investor. It's been a trend that's been playing out since the 2008 financial crisis. And there was something about it that bothered me. And I read a lot of Milton Friedman's work on this. He talked about this in the 1970s. And he said that this was going to make companies less efficient if they weren't just focused on making products. They were also focused on manufacturing social values that was going to distract them from being efficient. And there was something about that I definitely agreed with, but it wasn't the thing that bothered me. Something else bothered me, and I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. So I spent a year and a half writing this book, getting to the bottom of it. And the thing that really bothered me about it wasn't just that politics was going to infect business, but actually it was the reverse, that big business was going to infect the inner workings of American democracy. And I think that's actually the great challenge of our day, where big business is kind of engaging in this quiet backroom grand bargain. Today, with the left, it could be a different political movement in the future, but today it's with the left, to be able to do what it otherwise couldn't do without entering that arranged marriage. And so that, there's something really bothersome about that. I talk a lot more about that in the book, but I'm approaching this not as a journalist that did research and is reporting on my findings. I mean, this is the stuff that I had seen firsthand during my years as an investor, and then during my years as an entrepreneur building a company. I had seen corporate America firsthand, and I've also seen elite institutions firsthand, from Harvard to Yale to a lot of the nonprofits that I've been involved in. And I can say that there is now this cultural infection, right? My job as a biotech entrepreneur, I developed a lot of drugs. One of them probably that I'm most proud of is now an approved drug for the treatment of prostate cancer, and that's great. But this is a new kind of cancer. It's not a biological cancer. It is a cultural cancer that I think is literally infecting all of our institutions in the for-profit sector, in the nonprofit sector, in education, in government, the military, you name it. And, you know, it's what I call this new virus of woke culture that posits a particular theory about who you are as a person. But it's no longer just a fringe theory in the academy like it was in the 90s. It's now the dominant philosophy in all of our major institutions in America, and everyone is keeping quiet about it, especially people who are in positions of power and positions of importance in the private sector. So I felt some level of duty to be able to really blow the whistle on this trend and ultimately expose it for what it was. But that's only half the work. The harder work is actually paving a better path forward, and I try to do that in the book as well, laying out what a better future could look like in the private sector in America, and that's really been my focus for the last year.
And you had a piece recently in Newsweek in which you went through and you detailed what some people, employees who had been fired because of what you call, not what you call. I mean, a lot of people call it, the wokeness or woke culture. And I want to you compared, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but you really talk about how the Constitution and Supreme Court, its rulings on religion, and how woke culture essentially is being kind of viewed as a religion.
Yes. Yeah, so let me sort of lay out for you exactly what wokeism is all about, and then we can talk about the legal consequences of wokeism itself. So, wokeism or woke culture, whatever you want to call it, I think the output of critical race theory basically says that your identity is based on your race, your gender, and your sexual orientation, full stop. That if you're black, you're inherently disadvantaged. That if you're white, you're inherently privileged, no matter what your upbringing was, no matter what your economic background was. Your race and gender govern who you are, how you think, the thoughts you're allowed to have. That's not a characterization from my perspective. I think that's the characterization from every perspective. Even if you look at Ayanna Pressley, she's certainly a left-wing member of the squad in Congress. She actually summed it up pretty well herself when she said that we don't want any more black faces that don't want to be black voices. We don't want any more brown faces that don't want to be brown voices. Agree or disagree, that's the view. And to me, there's no such thing as a black voice or a brown voice. Those are just skin colors. But to the woke movement, it isn't just about your skin color. It is about your identity, who you are, and the thoughts that you're allowed to have. Now, what happened was, starting in 2008, after the financial crisis, I can talk about this more, there was effectively a way for Wall Street to occupy Wall Street up for adoption by instead jumping on the woke train and saying that actually corporate power isn't the problem. We don't need to redistribute wealth. What we really need to do is solve misogyny and racism in the United States. And that actually provided a great out for corporations. And so that supercharged this trend. But as it took over each of our institutions, it actually became the new secular religion in American institutions. It has a doctrine of original sin, namely the stain of whiteness. It has a doctrine of the kinds of clothing you can't wear, cultural appropriation, certain taboo words that you can't say, certain apology and confessional processes that you have to go through. There's a process of excommunication. That's what we call cancellation or being canceled in modern society. It has all of the hallmarks of religion in a way that actually meets the Supreme Court's own definitions for what counts as a religion. And so some of the solutions I lay out in the book are basically pretty simple solutions, which say that you can't have it both ways under the law, where Title VII of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 says that an employer actually cannot force an employee to bow down to any religion. They can't force them to bow down to a cross. They can't force them to bow down to a religious temple. And what I say is they can't force them to bow down to this religious temple any differently than they would any other religious temple. So that's actually the thing that people haven't really realized, is the extent to which this new dogma is the secular religion of our day. But if that's really right, then that has legal consequences. And, you know, I think that those are some of the arguments. I mean, that's just one example, but those are the kinds of arguments I lay out in the book for legal paths forward. If we really think this is a problem, you know, there's a number of legal solutions we could pursue. But I would also be the first person to say that these legal solutions are just symptomatic therapies. They just scratch the surface. What we really need is to do the hard work of delivering a cultural cure, but that's a longer conversation.
So your point is that this is taking over in business, and you're looking at it at this higher level. Where are you at the idea of, I mean, do you think that this kind of thinking is bad just in general in our country? Because woke has just become like this overarching word, but for like Black Lives Matters and for, you know, equality, how do you feel about it at the lower level? Are you concerned about that, or just you're looking at how it's infecting business?
No, so that's where I started with where it's infecting business, but I eventually delved into the content of woke philosophy itself, and including the Black Lives Matter movement. And actually, it turned out, if I'm really being honest with myself, that the thing that bothered me wasn't just the merger of wokeism with business, but was the content of critical race theory and wokeism itself. Because I think that that actually sets back 60 years of progress since we've made since the Civil Rights Revolution. And, you know, I'll tell you, one of the most meaningful moments of my education was in about 1993, when I was in second grade at Evendale Elementary. And I watched Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream speech, for the first time. And that was the speech where he said, I want my four children to grow up in a country where they would be judged not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. And it meant something to me, because that was actually the dream that allowed my own dad to succeed in this country. You know, he wasn't enormously financially successful or anything, but he succeeded in this country as a 40-year veteran of GE in Evendale. And he did it with a thick Indian accent. And my mom was a foreign medical graduate. She came here and treated patients with Alzheimer's disease despite growing up in a different country. And, you know, it was the dream that allowed me to succeed as a first-generation American as well. And so that really stuck with me and meant something to me. And the way I view woke culture is it effectively rejects the idea that we ought to live in a society that is colorblind, that looks beyond skin color exclusively to the content of our character. And I think that that's actually a shame, because it really defies not only the vision of Martin Luther King Jr., it defies the essence of the American dream itself. And we call it a dream for a reason.
But we don't live in a society like that yet. So these movements are meant to bring us to that dream. Do you agree or disagree with that?
That's a good point. That is definitely what, you know, my woke friends would say, is that we don't want America to work this way. This is just the way America does work today. Systemically racist, et cetera. And we have to recognize that and wake up to that before we move on to a better place. And so that's certainly what my woke friends have to say. I guess my own view is that the way we describe America actually affects the way America really works. And that's what I was starting to begin to say, is we call it a dream for a reason. It is something we aspire to. It's not an end state that we reach. Of course, America's imperfect. America's always been imperfect. America will always be imperfect. It is a dream for a reason, but it is the pursuit of perfection, the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of liberty, equality, and justice for all. So that much we all agree on. But I think that when we begin to describe ourselves in racialized terms by trying to use more race consciousness to to fight racism itself, we actually throw fuel on the fire of racism itself. We start with this new version of anti-white racism, which tells white employees in diversity training sessions that they're stained with the hallmarks of white privilege. That then makes them feel bad. And by the way, I'm not white, but I'm saying this in terms of what I've observed firsthand. That, you know, that hurts somebody to be accused of something. That then fuels a new wave of anti-black racism in response. And that actually triggers this new downward spiral that we've begun to see in the last few years. And my own view is similar to that of John Roberts. The best way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. I don't think more race consciousness is the answer. I think today more race consciousness is the problem. And we need to move to a world in which we actually recognize from coming off a decade of having celebrated our diversity and our differences as a people, moving on to a new decade where we revive what we still share in common as one people. And maybe it's well-intentioned from the left and from the woke movement. But despite the best of intentions, I still think that it actually reverses the progress that we have made towards realizing the e pluribus unum, from many one vision of the United States, and instead perverts that into from one many. And that's where we are today.
So you're a biotech entrepreneur. You majored in biology at Harvard, law school at Yale. And tell us how did you get into this forum? Like, how did you get – have you always been very politically engaged? Did you grow up with your parents very into politics?
Well, I've been politically interested on and off for a while, but I was actually a science guy in undergrad. So I studied molecular biology at Harvard. That was my calling at the time. I took a genetics class in my freshman year, decided biology was where it was at, spent a lot of time in the lab, and then I became a biotech investor after I graduated. But about 3 years into that, I realized that I had never really fully scratched the itch that I had in being interested in law and political philosophy. And so I told my bosses at the hedge fund where I worked at the time that, look, I need to go scratch that itch. I'm going to Yale for law school. I'll see you guys later. And they actually, something funny happened, which is that they said, actually, no, don't just leave. You can go manage a portfolio for us out there at Yale. Do it on your own time, but keep your job part-time if you don't mind. So I said, great, this is the dream world. So it was actually one of the early lessons for me of, you know, sometimes you just follow your passion and don't worry about the consequences. And sometimes good things tend to happen if you do that.
Wait, were your Yale law professors like, so now what's your night job?
I don't think that either world was too concerned with the other. And I loved having, I don't think most of my classmates were even aware that I was, you know, working as a hedge fund portfolio manager on my own time. And similarly, my hedge fund bosses didn't really care much about what I was bothering to learn in law school. Each world is so wrapped up in its own self, but that actually made it fun for me. I got to be in two different, very different worlds at the same time. And a third good thing happened is that my next door neighbor happened to be this med student who eventually went on to become my wife. So that was probably the most productive thing that came out of it. But those are, you know, I got to say, three of the best years of my life were, you know, the years that I spent indulging my intellectual itch in law school during the day, got to have fun investing in biotech, still doing something I enjoyed, you know, in the afternoons and evenings. And, you know, a nice time meeting my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. We had a great time exploring Connecticut and surrounding areas together. And so I don't know how we managed to do it all, but we had a lot of fun doing it.
I mean, Vivek, you, I know you sound humble about it, but you go on and you founded your own company. And you talked about, pharmaceuticals, Roivant Sciences, which you have since sold. Forbes reports that at a sale of $7 billion, 35 years old. And I mean, wow.
Well, thanks. Not to get too technical on the business side, it was technically going public by merging into a, you know, by announcing a merger into a so-called SPAC, but I won't go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, the bottom line is I had really been fulfilled for the 7 years that I was CEO of the company. I decided to step down as CEO in January of this year, marked the end of a chapter, you know, and in my own life, but allowed me also, among other things, to be able to speak with a personal voice, to not speak as a CEO anymore, but to speak as a citizen about this new set of issues. Because actually part of my issue is when CEOs use their market power or their standing to be able to foist social views on everyday Americans. That's, there's something about that that bothered me, and I wanted to practice what I preached as well. And I don't think that my voice is any more important than my neighbor here, that of my neighbor here in Westchester, but I do think it's important that we all speak up as citizens to restore that culture of free speech and open exchange of ideas in our democracy.
So if I go to buy your book in August in the bookstore, is it going to be in the political section or the business section?
That's a good question. It could fit in one of three sections, but kind of a political section, a business section, or a biography section. Because it's actually, like I said earlier, this isn't a research project. This is my personal experiences. So there's a lot of my personal experience that informs my views. So I'm not sure where they're going to put it. But for now, it's not in a section on the bookshelf. It's just available for pre-order online. So I'm encouraging people to pre-order the book because, you know, not because this is really intended to be a major commercial venture for me. If I do net any profits out of this, I intend to advance the movement. That's actually my goal here. But I do think it's important to get this message out. And there's a component of it that's relevant to the business world. I think there's a component of it that's relevant to the future content and question of a political movement in America about what it means to be an American at all. And there's a lot of my personal story that's wrapped up in there too. So that was what part of what made it meaningful to me.
Vivek, how are we just now? I mean, you're one of the great success stories, I think, to come out of Greater Cincinnati. And
well,
and I know people can go look.
Say. I don't know if I can accept that. But
people can go look up what you've done with your company, and all that, and the money, and all that. Like I know that seems probably a little uncomfortable to talk about. But folks, if they're curious, can go Google that. But how are we just now sort of – we're just now really learning about you here in your hometown.
Well, hey, listen, I've only begun to engage publicly outside the world of biotech after a long time in the last year and a half. And look, I got to say that the path to success certainly was not linear. And I don't expect the path to having a positive impact in my future pursuits through this book or otherwise – I don't expect that to be linear either. I had, you know, I think growing up, one of the things that my parents taught me and that, you know, I had in my experiences as a kid at Princeton schools through eighth grade, and one of which caused me to switch to St. X for high school in ninth grade. You know, I mean, I've learned through my life and my parents have learned it and taught me through their own experiences too, that hardship is not the same thing as victimhood. Hardship is part of what teaches us who we are. Even in my business career, actually, the first drug that we developed as a company was a drug for Alzheimer's disease. I was particularly passionate about Alzheimer's disease because, as I mentioned earlier, my mom built her career treating patients with Alzheimer's disease. And I remember how taxing it was for her to be able to treat those patients, but without medications that could really be effective in a meaningful way. And so that would always been a passion for me. It was actually the first major project we pursued as a company. Every Alzheimer's drug had failed. I'd found one that thought it had some promise. We ran it through the final stages of phase three development, spent a lot of money doing it. It was high profile. The whole world was watching it in the world of biotech. And when you flip the card on a clinical trial, there's risk. We knew that going in, and it failed. It was actually a major failure. And, you know, look, I think that was a really difficult experience for me, too. It was something that was emotionally difficult. It was difficult as a leader of a young upstart company to face a failure that was that high profile and that big early in my career. But at the end of the day, it created the foundation for developing other medicines for other diseases, some of which are in advanced in development, a couple of which are FDA approved products today and helping patients who need them, even if they're not for Alzheimer's disease, they're for other diseases. And so that's one of the lessons I've learned time and again, is that, you know, hardship is inevitable. In fact, hardship, though you don't see it at the time, is actually a good thing. It teaches you who you are and why you're doing what you're doing. And victimhood, I hate to say it, but I think it's true, is a choice that you make when you face hardship. And personally, I think that I encourage anyone I'm giving advice to make a choice in a different direction about using hardship as a chance to reflect on who we are as people, to be made stronger by it. And that's something that my parents taught me that stuck to me to this day. And it's probably the thing that allowed me to succeed on whatever scale I have.
Your name is coming up as being interested in, you talked about, you know, looking ahead for yourself, and your name's coming up, you know, for running for political office. Are you interested in doing that in your future?
Look, I'm open to it, but I got to say that for anybody who's pursuing political office, it's really got to be about public service. You have to be ready to make real sacrifices if you want to ultimately serve the public. And I think we're kind of in this leadership vacuum in a country where so many of the people who are doing it because that's the best job they could get. And I don't mean to offend anybody. I just think it's the truth. I've met enough public officials to be able to say that. That's not the system we want to live in. We want to live in a system where people choose to make a sacrifice, a trade-off in their personal life because they feel they could do a better job for their country. And so, look, we just had a 14-month-old. I've spent a lot of time writing this book. The decision I made is, at least in the near term, I actually wanted to really focus on really nailing this book. I did give some thought to whether I wanted to run for office this year or something like that. You know, it was something that a lot of people encouraged me to think about. I gave it a little bit of thought, but I felt actually the right way to have an impact was I was already, you know, a year pregnant into this book. Let me focus on that, see it through, get that message out locally and nationally. It's something that could affect the conversation, not just in government, but to me, a big part of the problem today isn't in big government alone. It's also in the private sector. And there were very few leaders who were willing to step up and point out what was wrong in corporate America and what the path forward could be for our non-government institutions, the private sector as we know it. So that's where I decided to focus my attention. I have to admit, writing a book is probably a little bit easier, and doing a book tour probably a little bit easier than running for office. It doesn't involve nearly as much sacrifice. But at some point, if better leaders don't step up, and if the conservative movement in particular continues to have a vacuum about what it even means to be a conservative, it's missing a North Star today. And I hope that some of the content of this book begins to provide what that guiding North Star, that compass could be for the future conservative movement, and more importantly, the future American movement. And I would love to see great leaders step up. It'd be easier for me if others did and run with that message. But at the end of the day, this country is only going to move forward if people are willing to step up and make the kind of sacrifices that are needed in order to lead the country.
Well, how do you view the Trump, you know, part of the party? As do you think it's taking things in a good direction when you're looking at your ideals that are in your book?
Yeah, so the way I look at the party, I assume you're talking about the Republican Party, but I view it a little bit differently. Here's what I do think. I think the two parts of the party view that's the dominant political analysis view today is itself destructive, because what that does is it belies the underlying intuition that a lot of Americans share, many Republicans, some Democrat, some apolitical, that the system is rigged against them, that elite institutions ultimately control a greater share of voice, not just in the marketplace for products, but in the marketplace for ideas and our moral norms in a way that defies what American democracy is supposed to be about. And I think if I'm speaking really candidly, having seen it from the inside, I think they're right, actually. And so a lot of those people certainly fall into the Trump wing of the Republican Party, as you put it. But a lot of those people are Republicans who may not prefer to have voted for Trump, may have held their nose while doing it. And a lot of those people may not identify as Republicans at all, but still recognize that the system is ultimately stacked against them because we have this new old world European model in America where a small group of business leaders, of institutional elites and political leaders work together to decide the common good, where American democracy, if it was supposed to be anything, for better or for worse, it was a world in which everyone's voice was weighted equally. And, you know, I've talked about the racial identity politics dimension of it, but we can even see it in the domain of science over the last year. And I'm personally passionate about the advancement of science, but we've also seen the way in which even science has been perverted over the last year from referring to a method of inquiry that relies on skepticism, that relies on open debate and open inquiry, to now being perverted into meaning what some authority figure has to say on a given day, turning that into a secular religion in its own right as well, with high priests of its own. So I think this is what I think a lot of people feel in their bones. And whether or not that manifests in them joining the Trump wing or a different wing or a different party, I actually think the thing that we've actually missed is business leaders, as institutional elites, as leaders in academia, what everyone's really missed is the way in which those intuitions are really valid, right? Those aren't something that you know, the so-called term popular on the East Coast now, the so-called rubes in the rest of America think. No, those are valid intuitions. They need to be channeled in a positive way, though. not in a constructive, not in a deconstructive, destructionist way. It needs to be channeled in a positive way to create something new that actually includes all Americans. It doesn't just use the word inclusion or diversity and inclusion as a way of excluding more people, which is actually what we see happening in the cultural environment today. But no, to channel those intuitions to say that actually we need to create an inclusive democracy where everybody's voice is weighted equally, where we can disagree with one another but still respect one another. And that's ultimately what's going to be required in order to move forward as one people. And do I think that there are mistakes that the woke left makes? Absolutely. That's what I write a lot about in the book. But do I think that there's mistakes that the far right or elements of the right, I wouldn't even call it the far right, but elements of people on the right who make the same mistake in reverse, beginning to deploy the tools of cancel culture in reverse? Sure. And I've been pretty focused on calling that out too as I see it, because I think that it's going to require both sides agreeing to engage in open dialogue and debate with respect without resorting to the use of force, including market force through canceling the other side, in order to ultimately live in a democracy where we can peaceably cohabit while still disagreeing with one another.
How would you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as a conservative. I'm a conservative through and through. I would have 10 years ago called myself more of a libertarian conservative. I've given up that label. And I'll tell you why, is that the free market that we idealize as Reaganite conservatives, that doesn't exactly exist today. And I'll give you an example when it comes to the issue of big tech censorship, right? Just to give an example. Classical wisdom would say that these are private companies that are free to do whatever they want and moderate the content that shows up on their sites. And I think that that's right in principle if they're really operating as private companies. But what we're really seeing today is something different, where the party in power, and you'll notice that big tech censorship of conservatives went up as Democrats took control of not only the House, but then the Senate and in the White House. What you see is something different, where the party in power is effectively using threats to say that we're going to regulate you, we're going to come after you, unless you take down hate speech or misinformation. Of course, as we define hate speech or misinformation as the party in power. And so we can't do that directly because there's this pesky thing called the Constitution and the First Amendment that prevents the government from engaging in political censorship. But you guys are just private companies. And so we're going to threaten you with regulation unless you go out and do that. But if you go do it, we'll look the other way and leave you alone. That's what's playing out. And by the way, there's this other pesky little statute called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that gives you immunity from any state liability if you go out and do just that. So you get a carrot and a stick from the government. That's not really private action. That is state action in the disguise of private enterprise. And that isn't a true free market. That's crony capitalism in reverse, where government is delegating its dirty work to the private sector that government couldn't do directly under the Constitution. And I think that's wrong. And so, that's the kind of thing that's happening every day in this country, where I think we need a new conservative solutions that aren't necessarily the libertarian model of 1980. It's kind of like what Abraham Lincoln said 160 years ago, is that, you know, the dogmas of a quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present, what he said in 1860. I say today the dogmas of 1980 for the conservative movement are inadequate to meet the challenges of 2021. And I've changed my mind on that.
So
this isn't what I thought 10 years ago, but that's where I am today.
You're talking about conservatism in the idea of business and what you've seen firsthand. And obviously we could talk about this for hours.
Sure.
Hence why you would write a book about it. But so where does it fit in then, these traditional, you know, conservative ideas that are, you know, pro-gun rights, anti-abortion? I mean, are those still issues that have to be played out in politics? Or does it – you're talking about a higher level conservatism business.
Well, look, I think the calling card for the future conservative movement and what it means to be a cultural conservative today is a little different than what it meant to be a cultural conservative even in 2010. And to me, I think this is an opportunity for the conservative movement, where we lack an answer to the question of what it means to be a conservative right now, but we also lack a question, an answer to the question of what it means to be an American right now. And I think that there's an opportunity to answer both of those questions in one fell swoop, to be able to revive basic ideas like the American dream, exceptionalism, reason, faith, science, all of those in one, as the set of ideas that plurally define us as Americans and bring us together across our racial lines, across our political lines, across the divisions that have otherwise fractured us over the course of the last decade. That actually is the opportunity what cultural conservatism ought to be about, rejecting the narrative of diversity with a capital D that elevates our differences above our commonality, to instead say that actually the thing we care about is our shared American identity, irrespective of the color of our skin, irrespective of our sexual orientation, irrespective of our gender or gender identity. These things don't matter compared to the backdrop of our shared commonality as one people. In fact, diversity, in my opinion, is meaningless unless there's something greater that binds us together as one people, because without that, we're just a bunch of higher mammals walking around in a common space doing what our iPhones tell us to do on a given day. And that's not America. That's not humanity. Humanity is more than that. So I think that that's what the essence of cultural conservatism ought to be about. And, you know, based even on my interactions locally and otherwise, including in preparing for the rollout of this book, I think that message is highest on the priority list of cultural conservatives today, too, to redefine the essence of American identity on the shared ideals and history that we share in common, rather than the kind of fractious, skin-deep group identity that we're seeing emerging as the popular counter-narrative in the last 10 years.
So because you're predicted to run, and do you see yourself as okay, let me back up. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but what you're saying is you want conservatives to stop dwelling so much on social issues. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't even – not quite. I'm reframing the social issue that's most important in our day. I think the social issue that's most important in our day is to revive what it means to be an American, both in our own minds and in the next generation. So I think that that's actually where the focus ought to be, is in educating the next generation through – civic education, through a sense of this is our shared history that brought us together, not to claim that we were perfect at every step of the way when we weren't, of course not, but to fight back against the new narrative that obsesses over all of the ways we have fallen short of our ideals, that has caused us to forget what those ideals even were. So what I think about is the new cultural, what it means to be a social issue, or the top social issue, the top cultural issue for being a conservative, ought to be elevating American idealism above the new philosophy of race consciousness and wokeism in America today. To me, that should be, I'm willing to say this, the top cultural or social issue for conservatives ought to be educating the next generation on the civic values that bind us together as Americans, and elevating that over the fractious group identity politics that has been dominant over the diversity decade of the 2010s.
Are you also saying, like, stop focusing on the abortion issue?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that's an important issue, and I'm not going to add anything original to that conversation. So I think that that's been asked and answered over the course of the last 20, 30, 40 years in terms of where the political parties fall. But I think that where do you fall at this moment? Yeah, I consider myself pro-life, you know, not without nuance, right? I think these are nuanced issues. I think that the facile answer is for the left is that, you know, this is about an issue relating to freedom of the woman. And no, I think that there is actually a real basic question about human life and protecting human life. It's really important to me. But I, you know, that isn't an issue that I have made a core part of my voice or my identity as a writer or as an author. I'm more focused on the issues relating to identity that we've talked about here.
You're talking a lot about where you want to see the Republican Party, where you want to see politics. Do you see yourself as a leader of the future of that movement, of the Republican Party? I mean, do you see yourself as that?
Well, look, what I'm doing over the next 6 months is really rolling out the message of the book that I've spent the last year and a half thinking deeply about. And I'll tell you this, even if for whatever reason the book never got printed in a hypothetical world, I'm still glad that I spent the last year and a half doing it, because too often we know what we believe, but we forget why we believe it. And I think I've had the good fortune of spending the last year, pandemic and all, to maybe find a silver lining, help aid that by being home rather than being on airplanes, traveling from place to place, to really reflect deeply on, you know, having a kid, I think, influenced me too, to really reflect deeply on why it is we believe what we believe and what it is we care about passing on to the next generation. So right now I'm focused on rolling that message out in the form of the book, and really to get reactions in response, to really see whether this is the kind of message that helps unify Americans, but also give people a sense of hope at a time when we could use that as we bind ourselves together as one people. So, you know, I think the early signs are good, and I'm really gratified and pleased by the way this message seems to be touching people in their everyday life. Now, I think that if other great leaders don't step up to carry on that baton, that's something I'm going to give serious consideration to. But I'm not going to really engage with that or think about it even personally until at least the end of this year, I would say.
So I have to say, I wouldn't ask, you know, just our regular guests, could you run for president someday? Because that's like a little kind of far-fetched. Right? Like, we have people on this podcast where we're like, are you running for mayor? You know, it turns out there's a Senate race next year in Ohio that everyone's running for. So, I mean, you seem to have the means and, you know, the ideals to position yourself to do something like that grand, like run for president.
And your role.
Is that what you're talking about? Like, that you're... Well, after the book tour, that's the kind of thing you're thinking about?
I would say this. I come back to what I said earlier, which is public service ought to be about service and willingness to actually make a sacrifice. And for me, I really mean this when I say it. There is no position too high or too low to fit that description. I think it's got to be a real question about how you can have the biggest possible impact you can have. And one of the things I frequently say is actually probably the most impactful position that I could think of today is service on a school board or the equivalent that's affecting the way the next generation is actually being educated. That's something that everyday Americans can step up into and do today. And I think each of us has to kind of find where we think we can make our own unique contributions. And, you know, if I'm being really, really candid with you, I think there is no position for me that would be either too low or too high to consider. It's a question of where I think I can have the maximal impact and what makes the most sense in terms of the need and where there's a leadership vacuum. So to be honest, I'm not even going to turn to thinking about it till I'm done with the book launch. And after that, I'll give some thought to what comes next for me.
That's what everyone says when a reporter asks them if they're running for president. I'm just going to leave that right there then.
Well, you would know more about that than me then. Okay.
Vivek, I have one more question for you. And then I want to let you share where people can purchase the book. Today's Republican Party, we're seeing, you know, quite a schism right now with what's going on with Liz Cheney and the party. And which side are you? Which side are you on? Are you on the side that the Republican Party needs to move beyond Trump? Or are you on the side where the Republican Party needs to embrace Trump and roll with him?
See, I'm really beyond that question in the sense that I don't really care about the politics of it. I mean, that's what people in Washington, D.C. right now are obsessing over, and they can continue to do that if that's their job to do it. But what I actually care more about is the absence of the content of what it actually means to be a conservative. I don't think the Republican Party has a good answer to that question. That's why I've actually stopped even describing myself as a Republican. I describe myself as a conservative because I know what it means to be a conservative. But I don't even know what it means to be a Republican today. And I think that's actually the issue that we need to solve, is irrespective of who it is. I find these biographical questions so boring. I mean, Liz Cheney is a person. Donald Trump is a person. None of these are demigods that we ought to bow down to as though we belong to one camp or another, as though these are figures that we pledge fealty by bending the knee to. I could care less about who the people are. I care more about the content of what it actually means to be a conservative. And as I said before, we lack an answer to that question every bit as much as we lack answer to the question of what it means to be an American. And I care much more about filling that void with ideas. And I think in some ways, our obsession with whether you're in one camp or another camp or the person you pledge fealty to has just been a different form of group identity politics that's actually mimicking the far left without actually recognizing the way in which the thing we're really missing are common values that we either believe and subscribe to or don't. And so I find these biographical debates, frankly, not only boring, but counterproductive because they distract us from the real debate. And I think it is a debate that we ought to be having in the conservative movement about, let's take an issue like immigration, right? I'm seeing a schism in the Republican Party that we need, and I'm on one side of it, that we need to explore, where I think all of us in the conservative movement are against illegal immigration. I consider myself a hardliner when it comes to being against illegal immigration. But I am in favor of legal immigration that actually helps provide the lifeblood and flow for new people who come to this country through the front door, as my parents did, allowed me to live the American dream. And I think there are people in the Republican Party who oppose that, who think that, you know, and I'm not saying that that's wrong. Personally, maybe they have their reasons for having their views, but want to see not only less illegal immigration, but want to see less legal immigration too. I want to be talking about more about those issues and not about some sort of bullfight between a Donald Trump wing and a Liz Cheney wing, which I just find, frankly, pretty boring.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us here today and speaking your mind and you know, the book you have coming out. I want to ask you, how can folks the book comes out in August. Are pre-orders going on right now? How can people
find that?
Yeah,
I would love for folks to pre-order the book. I think that'll help it, you know, really be a part of the conversation as soon as it comes out. People can go to, you know, Google it, Woke Inc., Vivek Ramaswamy. It's on Amazon. It's on most booksellers' web pages today. You can put in a pre-order. You'll get it when it comes out on August 17th. And I look forward to talking about it more. It's going to be something that I've spent a lot of time on. These are obviously topics that are really important to me, and I'm really grateful for anyone who takes the time to read it.
Thank you so much. This is was an unusual conversation for the podcast. Like, really, just like this, you know, ideal thinking, and
we didn't even get a chance to ask you about being a libertarian hip hop artist while you were at Harvard.
Yeah, probably for the better. That was my whole tactic the whole time to avoid that one. I'm just kidding. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it via performance, guys.
What's your favorite memory from St. Axe?
Oh, that's a good.
It's graduation time now.
I have a lot of favorite memories from St. Axe, actually.
It wasn't that long ago, either.
Wasn't that long ago. You know, in 2003, I spoke at St. Axe graduation at Cintas Center, and I'm actually going back to do that this year. They invited me back to be their commencement speaker this year. So, you know, it'll be interesting to go back. I mean, I was reflecting on it. This is the first class that's graduating, I think there's not a single kid in the class who was alive around 9/11, which happened right when I was at St. X, actually, myself. And, you know, they had a different international tragedy that they went through in the year of COVID-19. It affected their sports and, you know, things that, you know, theater Xavier, as they call it, for the theater group, and, you know, kids who weren't able to do everything they wanted to do. And, you know, it reminded me a little bit of what it felt like in a very different way. But after 9/11, I was actually in U.S. history class, believe it or not, when a different social studies teacher stuck his head into the room and said, "They hit us on Sec Tower." And that moment, you know, that moment stuck with me. And, you know, it was a long time ago, but you guys were around then too. You remember what that was like. And, you know, to talk to a generation of kids who graduated when they weren't even born when that happened, but now at the same time have gone through, you know, a unique global challenge that touched their lives in a different way this year was kind of sentimental to me. And so I haven't really written my speech yet. I probably should. It's coming up pretty soon. So I need to get on that. But something relating to that was giving me inspiration. And so
I feel like you're on the right track there. You have
I need to think about it a little more.
Congratulations on all
your case today. I'll try to make some progress on that. Well, thanks guys for having me. I got to jump in about another minute.
Thanks,
thank you. That was fun.
Right, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks again to Vivek Ramaswamy. Sherry, that was a lot, interesting guy. And I need two cups of coffee to get really into that in depth of an intellectual discussion.
You know, I said it while Vivek, we were going. Obviously, you know, that's just kind of like thoughtful political, you know, ideals that you could talk about all day.
No doubt. And certainly we'll be keeping up with Vivek's career moving forward, because I think you'll see him. Here's my thought. I think you could see him two things right now in the immediacy or in the next few years. If Warren Davidson runs for Ohio governor next year, I could see Vivek potentially jumping in and running for Congress in what is John Boehner's former seat. Or I could see Vivek challenging or being a challenger, if it's probably, there'll probably be a big GOP primary, 2024 for Sherrod Brown's seat, against Sherrod Brown. I think he has his eyes set on big things as you asked him about. Hey, do you think you might run for president someday? I think Vivek has his eyes set on big, big things in politics.
He certainly hinted at it.
Not, no doubt. And when you see what he's been doing, he's been writing for a lot of national publications. He's on Fox News regularly as a guest. And he's really trying to build a national profile. Anyway, this is our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. And I went to try to manufacture a week this week, or a moment this week. People on Twitter were talking about the new Grater's flavor, black raspberry cookies and cream. Is that correct? Yes.
Yes.
And so the Williams fam jumped in the minivan, went to Grater's last night. Wah, wah. Sold out. Not getting a new batch in unless it's on Winton Road until Thursday. And so I thought, well, there goes my Cincinnati moment. But no, that is my Cincinnati moment, is that Cincinnati loves its Grater's so much that they sold that thing out in the first day.
I mean, this is like a marriage of like people's two favorite flavors. And I have to say, so I brought this up to Jack Coolidge yesterday, 13 years old. Black raspberry chip is his favorite thing in the whole world, next to cheese conies. And I was like, guess what happened? And I was shot down. I thought like that was a sure trip to Grater's. And he told me that he just felt that you cannot rival the original, nor should you try. That was kind of his take on it. And he's like, no, thank you. So you'll have to let us know how it is next week.
Jack Coolidge, he's a, like myself, a connoisseur of ice cream. My love for ice cream is only rivaled by my love for Cincinnati style chili. I have been known, and my friends know this, that it's not nothing for me to just have. And I know some people do this with cereal or whatever. Saturday night, I think we'd eaten a big lunch or something, and we were all just kind of like, well, whatever for dinner. Well, I had a bowl of ice cream, and that was my dinner, and it was UDF.
During the pandemic, people were like hoarding the toilet paper and hand sanitizer, and I'm not that kind of person, which did actually leave
the Coolidges. You're just not that kind of person.
Short on some things because I wasn't like crazy and running out. And so then it was like you had to buy the toilet paper, buy the pack, like four rolls at a time. But there was a story at one point during the pandemic that there was a shortage of black raspberry chip ice cream. I did go to the store and stock up just in case. And it didn't really turn out to be a shortage, but we were ready. Like, we didn't have hand sanitizer or toilet paper, but God forbid we had black raspberry chip ice cream.
So one more thing about Cincinnati ice cream in particular, and that's usually what I like, although I also will buy Turkey Hill. But I think what an underrated ice cream is, and it's a Cincinnati ice cream, I think it could technically be considered that. No, it's not UDF. No, it's not Grater's. No, it's not
Agamemnon. I don't know where you're going with this.
My dad got me on this. And then since my parents moved to South Carolina a little over a year ago, every time we've gone, about four or five times a visit so far. And every time we've gone, my dad has at least one carton of Kroger's Death by Chocolate flavor in the freezer. And sometimes he's got two cartons of it in there. And I'm like, Dad, like, and I knew he always liked ice cream, but now it's like a constant thing. He has ice cream in the freezer.
What is in it?
I mean, it's Death by Chocolate. It's like all kinds of chocolate. And it's almost like a Rocky Road, but without the marshmallow. And it's fantastic.
All right, Jason coming in hot with a recommendation.
Death by Chocolate, Kroger. I'm also on the UDF chocolate chip peanut butter chocolate chip. I'll just full disclosure. I bought a carton of it 2 weeks ago, and on a Monday and on Friday I finished it off.
All right, I'm going to leave you guys with this thought. Both Jason and I are supposed to be on our post-pandemic diets. How's that going, Jay?
I was on a run there for a while. I think I even talked about it on the podcast where I had gone like 3 weeks without ice cream. And
no, I don't remember you saying something that crazy. I'd remember.
Or I said something like, I think I gave the date. I was even keeping track of it. And why can't I just like not love like apples and broccoli? No, it's got to be Cincinnati chili and ice cream. Those have got to be my two things.
You have good taste. It's fine.
Anyway, Hope you can get out and try some Graders, UDF, Kroger, Death by Chocolate. Support the local companies if you can. And we will catch you next week.